Hi, everybody. We are live. Let me toot over here that we're live. Yeah, right.
We have. I actually don't mind toot as a name. I know a lot of people find it incredibly tacky.
I love it.
I can't tell if that's.
I was just updating the frame game code, and in all the code, I have variables with tweet in the name, and now I have variables with toot in the name.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is childish, but I don't mind it. Like, whatever.
I don't think it's childish. I think it's childish to think there's a problem with it. You just be a mature person. You say this is a fun, fanciful name that relates to elephants. Thumbs up. And it begins with a T and sounds kind of like tweet. Like, obviously, it's piggybacking on existing nomenclature for stuff. It's so much better than saying post. I heavily endorse toot, even though, as we know, it has been officially renamed in the source code for the software that most of these sites are using, but who cares? I'm still calling them toots.
In any case, we have some housekeeping to do. First of all, this past Monday, as we record, we released the fourth episode, the bonus fourth episode in what was intended to be a three-part trilogy as opposed to a four-part trilogy. I don't know. Anyway, it was supposed to be a trilogy on the ATP Movie Club, and we righted my wrong. Well, I'm not sure it was wrong, but these two would say it was wrong. We righted my decision. Oh, fine. We fixed my faux pas earlier in choosing The Rundown as my ATP Movie Club choice from earlier. Instead, in addition, we have done and recorded and published for members. We have published ATP Movie Club number 4, which is The Hunt for October, 1990-1991. I forget what year it was. One of my favorite movies of all time. And Marco had never seen it, and John had thoughts. With that said, stay for The Hunt for Red October talk, but come for the popcorn argument that we had in the very beginning. I will say nothing else.
Yes.
I will say nothing else, but that the member special, within the span of probably 60 seconds, maybe even 45 or 30 seconds, we got into an argument about popcorn. And so if that is something that interests you, and it should be, atp.fm/join. And again, this is correct me, Marco, this will appear in both the bootleg and the members only feeds. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
That way, like, in case you only listen to the bootleg feed, you don't miss it.
There you go. So I do recommend it. How long is it, Marco? Do you recall? It was like 45-ish minutes,
something like that. Yeah,
maybe an hour
long.
Tops. It's not two or three hours. Oh, actually, it's longer than I thought. Well, anyways, it's not too much. It is absolutely not required listening, but I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a fun episode. And again, the argument in the beginning is worth the price of admission, if you ask me. So atp.fm/join. Also, I messed up last week. I forgot to recognize that the three of us have been podcasting together for 10 years now. ATP has not yet hit 10 years. That's coming in a couple of months. But the first episode of Neutral, where I introduced myself to the internet by swearing at Marco, if memory serves,
that is correct,
was released on the 17th of January, 2013. So the three of us as a team have been podcasting for 10 years. And if you had told me when I was when I was discussing with Aaron whether or not it was worth spending the, I don't know, $200 or $300 on a Rode podcaster and the boom and so on and so forth, and I said to her, you never know what'll happen, and she was like, yeah, I guess you're right, but geez, that's a lot of money. I know you're right, it is a lot of money, but you never know. Well, that was 10 years ago, and a lot's changed since then. So genuinely, from the bottom of our hearts, thank you to everyone who has listened to Neutral, who has listened to ATP, who has joined as an ATP member. Thank you to all of you. It has been an unbelievably cool and wild ride for all of us to be doing this for 10 years together. Obviously, you two have been doing it quite a bit longer than I, but as a unit, the three of us have been going for 10 years.
What is it that
doing,
makes somebody want to buy a white car?
We'll never know.
And speaking of that being a neutral thing, like, I feel like this is a occasion inflation, right? Where you're like, oh, let's celebrate the day we first met and the day, we went on our first date and the first time we held hands, and it just keeps going and going. And it's like, if you're going to start from the day we did Neutral, but then what about also the day we started ATP? And then what about the day we recorded the first ATP? And what about the day the first ATP was released? And what about the day ATP.fm went up? And it's just, there's too many holidays. We really need to pick one and stick with it. And if I had to pick one, I would have picked publication date of first episode of ADU. But now you've blown it. Now we've done the 10 years thing. So I'm putting a moratorium on 10 years of podcasting.
No, no, we still have to recognize there's one more date to recognize as far as I'm concerned. And that is when we announced ATP, which I have on linked to my website. I still have all my tweets up because I'm an idiot. March 11, 2013. Listen to Marco Arment, Syracuse, and I talk tech. If cars isn't your thing, the Accidental Tech Podcast, ATP.fm.
We'll celebrate Casey's Gotcha Day.
Yep, that's right. That's right. March 11th, 2013. That is the only remaining celebration with regard to the 10-year anniversary of us.
You know about Gotcha Days, Marco? I know Casey does.
Is that like when you pick up a puppy or something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like it's not the dog's birthday, but it's the day that you get the dog.
Aw, it's really cute. We're still not going to celebrate that, but it's really cute.
Gotcha Day Gotcha Day isn't really occasion inflation because you might not know the dog's birthday, so you just have to go with Gotcha Day because you do know that one. But
I know my dog's birthday. I know because I got it from a breeder. And
not everybody knows. So
know.
That's
all the people who got dogs the correct way probably don't know. I got my dog the incorrect way, and therefore I know his birthday, and it's adorable. And I gave him like a little extra treat every day, and he has.
We know our dog's birthday roughly too because the mother was rescued. And then I think maybe they just back solve from like we rescued the mother with a litter of puppies and they look about round about this, you know, this age or whatever. But sometimes you could have a rescue that's pregnant and then gives birth. Anyway, it's possible to know if you get a rescue.
Yeah, because we're pretty darn sure that Penny's actual birthday is the day before Declan's, but her gotcha day is, I think, the 30th of December. I forget. We have it on the calendar, but it's something like that. So we actually happen to know as well, even though she was a rescue. So turns out. Anyway, we should do some follow-up, and hey, the new Mac Mini is the same size as the old one, ? What's going on here?
Definitively, no question mark. So it's definitively in multiple aspects. So lots of people who have them say, oh, they're the same size, I can tell. Mac Stadium, one of those companies that rack mounts these things or whatever, also confirms it in a blog post that we'll link, and I would trust them because they're the ones who would care about millimeter differences. And lots of people have gone deep into, well, why are the numbers different on Apple's website? And what it comes down to is probably just differences in rounding and significant digits and what units they're in. And someone did a dive of like, okay, well, if they did it this way, if they measured it in millimeters, then converted to inches, then rounded to one significant digit, but then converted the inches to centimeters. And, you know, I don't, the real question is, why did Apple change the way they round these numbers on their website? Maybe it was just, I don't know, some new person doing it, or someone didn't know the old way or whatever, but it seems like a little stumble. Like if it really is the same size, why change these? Maybe it was a company-wide policy change. It was like, from now on, for all our hardware products, we're always going to do things in this particular order so we don't have any variances. But anyway, the Mac Mini is the same size as the old Mac Mini. And other people have said that they think also the 14-inch MacBook Pro is the same size, but I haven't seen that one confirmed. But Mac Mini, same size.
All right. And then there's another kerfuffle with regard to SSD speeds and the new Mac Mini. So I don't have a whole ton of patience for this. Like, it is a thing. It is real. But I feel like it's one of those, we got you. We got you, Apple. We caught you red-handed. And it's like, yeah, okay, fine. So the short version, John, you can give the long version. But the short version is, think about maybe not getting the smallest SSD available on basically any current Apple product because it's probably going to be a little bit slower than all the others.
Oh, a little bit, half the speed. So we talked about this at length the first time it happened, which I think was like the M2 MacBook Air. It's the same issue as that, that for a given SSD size, they'll put half as many chips on the motherboard because instead of they can get one chip that is the entire capacity. But that halves the bandwidth of the SSD to the SoC and making it roughly half the speed when benchmarked. And it's usually only on the lowest of low-end things. So in this example, the $599 M2 Mac Mini, the bottom-end one that comes with a 256-gigabyte SSD, it has one SSD chip on the motherboard that is 256 gigabytes, and then it has a blank spot where the other SSD chip would go. And that Mac Mini, which is $100 cheaper than the M1 one is, the SSD is about half the speed of the M1 because the M1 Mac Mini didn't have this problem. It came with two 128 gigabyte chips and it had the full bandwidth. Same exact issue exists on the M2 MacBook Pro, if anyone remembers that thing, the M2 MacBook Air. And it it's annoying because I understand maybe it's a cost savings in an economy of scale or whatever, but it's not just like, oh, it's 5% slower or whatever. It's literally half the speed. Most people don't care about that speed, but it makes the lowest end model, it makes it so you have to warn people. Here's an annoying thing we have to warn you about. We didn't have to do this with like the M1 MacBook Air, for example. There's nothing to warn anybody about that. It's just decide how much storage you want, decide how much memory you care about, but like there's no sort of like hidden thing you have to worry about. And now apparently this is a thing that Apple's going to roll out these product lines and for like maybe for the whole M2 generation through some cost saving measure or whatever, you have to warn people, hey, if you actually care about SSD speed, which you probably don't, but you might, don't get the lowest end one. And it makes the lowest end one the worst deal. The best example is the MacBook Pro, which is like a machine that starts at $2,000, and you get a $2,000 machine. But if you're not careful, if you got the lowest end $2,000 one with the 256 gig SSD because you didn't need that much space, it's half the speed. $2,000 machine shouldn't be crippled in this way. So this is a thing. It is known. It is not really a news story, but it's something to keep in mind. It's something for listeners of this show to keep in their mind if they have any relatives or friends who are thinking of buying any one of these Macs, to just to let them know, hey, if you're going to, you know, and you may think, oh, it's never going to come up. If you just web browse an eBay, it'll never be a factor. You never know what people are going to do with their computers. And like, and it's like I said, it's not 5% slower. It's 50% the speed of the thing. So I really wish Apple and the M3 generation stops doing this. Or here's another option, Apple, stop shipping 256 gigabyte SSDs right on any of your computers.
So true.
We can hope.
We can hope. All right, let's see if we can get through this quickly. since we last recorded, Twitter has officially, for realsies this time, banned third-party Twitter clients. They updated their developer agreement on Thursday, the 19th of January, with a clause banning, quote, use or access the licensed materials to create or attempt to create a substitute or similar service or product to the Twitter applications. The addition is the only substantive change. I don't think I pronounced it right. But anyway, it's the only big change in the 5,000-word agreement.
The funny thing is, I think you actually did. I think it's substantive, which is what you pretty much said.
You got it right the first time.
Oh, my bad. Anyways,
the one
Andy
time
Bayo,
you get it right.
I know. Let me throw whom in there. I'm sure I'll get that right, too.
Yes.
The diff was from Andy Bayo, which we'll link in the show notes, and it is exactly as described. There's almost no difference. This is kind of gross. Like, it's within their right to do so. And I think Ben Thompson was leading the charge, or at least of the people that I've heard, leading the charge that, hey, they should have done this a long time ago, if you think about Twitter's business from Twitter's perspective. And I think that does make sense. But the way they did it, the way they made this happen, was super gross. Like, on the 17th, so this was right, I think, before we recorded, the Twitter dev Twitter account tweeted, Twitter is enforcing its longstanding API rules that may result in some apps not working. Like, get the F out of here.
I love the fact that they included longstanding. So setting aside the arrow of time, which dictates that the 19th comes later than the 17th, right? This is their one and only official communication that even vaguely relates to explaining why all our Twitter apps weren't working. It didn't name any specific apps, and it cited longstanding API rules. 2 days later, they made like a one-line change to the Twitter developer agreement to ban all third-party applications. So anyway, this is just conclusively, in case you were wondering. No, they still didn't say what they were doing, still didn't give any explanation or reasoning or whatever, still did it without communicating for, I think it was like a week or 5 days, 6 days before anybody knew anything. But then eventually, finally, on the 19th, they, you know, updated their developer, again, without any communication to anybody. The only reason people know this is someone was looking at the developer agreement and saw the diff, right? That says, yeah, no, all third-party applications that try to be like the Twitter clients are banned. So this is the conclusion to that story. The conclusion is that there are a bunch of jerks over there at Twitter and all third-party clients are dead.
Yep. And you know, Tweetbot has formally said, you know, it is no more. Twitterific has formally said it is no more.
They said that before the 19th, actually.
Oh,
before,
sorry. That's true. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because they're like, you know, obviously when Twitter says, yeah, you can't have a third-party client anymore, that ends everybody. But even before that, they had given up because their apps had been inexplicably banned, right?
And it's just, I was listening to Connected before we recorded, and I think Federico hit the nail on the head. Like, it's just Twitter, or it seems like at the very least Elon, is just without class. Like, there's just no class. Like, whether or not you think he's bright, whether or not you think he makes good decisions. And again, I could make a strong argument that this was, from the perspective of Twitter, a good decision. I don't like it at all, but I understand it. But it was just done in such a gross, classless way. And I hate it so much. I love, though, however, dear friend of the show, Jason Snell, replying to that Twitter dev tweet. And hello, future Marco, because you're going to have to deal with this. Jason said, and I am quoting, "You are full of shit." And that was the entire tweet. And it was so perfect. I loved it so much. And then he replied to himself 2 days later with a link to Engadget, you know, talking about the new rules within. And the contents of his tweet, other than the link, was, quote, "Longstanding," quote. Just so good. I love it so much. Oh gosh. Anyway, it's just gross. It makes me feel terrible for Tapbots, for the Icon Factory. It's just gross. Like, there's ways you could have handled this that weren't gross. And, you know, Elon, as he always does, chose violence. So what are you gonna do?
Yeah. And I think, you know, if there is, if we can somehow turn, you know, this horrible thing for these developers into a positive thing at all. You know, keep in mind that these two apps, especially in the case of Tapbots, like, this is like the vast majority of their income. And for Icon Factory, for Tweetbot, that, or for for Twitterific, Twitterific is a pretty substantial chunk for them. This is a really, really good time for the community to help out these two developers by looking at their other software, and if you could use any of it, buy it. This is the time, like right now, because this just came out of nowhere for them. And these are two really fantastic app developers that have been on the platform for an extremely long time. You know, I think it would be really nice for the community to help them through this transition. You know, Icon Factory has a lot of other apps. I love Linea, their sketch app for iPad.
Tot is excellent as well.
Yep, Tot is fun. Like, it's kind of this, like, almost like a little like memo clipboard kind of management. It's really cool. Anyway, check out these apps. And then Tapbots just launched Ivory, their Mastodon client. I strongly suggest look at these two companies' apps, buy them if you can, and if you can use them. If there is some way to give them money, please take that option now, because these are great developers and we want to support them, because this is the kind of apps, like, what these two developers make are such top-notch apps. These are the kind of apps that make the platform special. These are the kind of developers that we want to support that don't do any of the, like, you know, weird privacy tracking BS or, like, scammy kind of things that we see so often in other places in the App Store. This is the kind of app that we should support. This is the kind of developer that deserves our support. So please help them out. Buy their stuff. If you're on Mastodon, which I strongly suggest, if you're on Mastodon, definitely go get Ivory. It is a fantastic Mastodon client so far, and they're constantly working on more of it. There's going to be a Mac version, from what I understand, in probably the near future as well, which will radically improve my life.
Yeah, same.
So yeah, check out their work, and this is the time to do it.
Yeah, just to make absolutely clear, Ivory is publicly available on the App Store. It had been
it had been on a
semi-open beta where they would release slots or they would release signups for test flight. But now it is for realsies in the App Store, and anyone can get it right now. And also, to go back to the Icon Factory very briefly, I don't use Xscope a lot, but it is invaluable when you are trying to work out UI related things on a Mac. Like, if you're even in the simulator, it doesn't matter. It probably even supports iOS in ways that I'm not even familiar with. But one way or another, Xscope is also great. So yeah. Again, from the Icon Factory, Linea, Tot, Xscope, from Tapbots, Ivory, all of these get, you know, my highest recommendation. And I think I probably speak for both you fellows in saying that. So please check them out.
If you're a Mac developer, one reason to get Xscope, aside from the obvious, like, oh, I'm using it to measure stuff on my screen related to my app. If you're a Mac developer, you have to do screenshots for the Mac App Store, if that's where you're selling. And that usually involves arranging windows and then taking screenshots on a Mac. And if you want to do that in a repeatable way, Xscope is great for that because you can set up frames and guides and all sorts of other things that Xscope does. And of course, it saves them and they're persistent. That will let you precisely position the windows of your application so that from version to version, your screenshots like, oh, where did I put this? Was it centered on the screen? How high was it? You know, like, do I have to line it up to the mountains in the desktop background so exactly in the same spot? Xscope solves all of that for you. You just turn on all the guides and frames and everything, line up your window. Turn off all the stuff, take your screenshot. So handy.
Yeah, like imagine, like, you know, if you've ever been using, you know, Photoshop or something like that, and like you know maybe like you drag a box or something and you see like, oh, it's telling me how many pixels that is. How convenient. Xscope is like having that kind of little convenient thing for anything on your screen, just as an overlay to your screen, among many. I mean, it's one of those apps. There's so many little tools built into it, so it's one of those apps, like, it isn't just one thing, but that's one of the things, and that's the thing that I really enjoy about it. I use that all the time.
Yep. And then continuing to talk about Twitter, and by the way, we did pretty well. That didn't take that long, so let's see how long this one takes. Twitter, their infrastructure seems to be crumbling very slowly and somewhat quietly. John Gruber over at Daring Fireball, I remarked over a week ago that I was no longer seeing mentions or replies directed at my Twitter account. For a day or two, I was seeing a handful of them, but now they're gone. At this writing, I see a grand total of one mention for my account going back to January 5th. My Twitter mentions are nearly completely useless. For well over a decade, Twitter mentions have been my primary way of interacting with the Daring Fireball audience. Obviously, that's no longer possible. So be it. All the good action is over at Mastodon now. Anyway, now, just to be clear, I have literally a tenth of the followers that John has on Twitter. And I would get, I don't know, somewhere between 10 to 50, you know, app mentions a day, maybe 100 on a slightly busier day, and obviously a lot more if something really blew up. For John Gruber to have five or whatever he said, like, or one, clearly something is broken here, because there is no chance that Gruber is getting only one mention a day. I mean, I guess anything's possible, but I would be just dumbfounded. So this is indicative that maybe things are not going well over at Twitter world.
I would also say, too, like, you know, when comparing follower counts between Twitter and Mastodon, it's not really a great direct comparison, because Mastodon, you know, most of the people who were posting there and getting engagement there, it's a fairly new thing. And so whereas on Twitter, a lot of the followers that, you know, us old accounts have, many of those people, first of all, aren't real. Second of all, have abandoned their accounts, but their accounts still exist, so they still count as a follower. And then third of all, because Twitter is algorithmic timeline-based, previously for most of its people, now for all of its people since they killed these apps, not everyone who you follow is even going to see your post, even if they read, quote, their entire timeline, whatever that's being shown to them at that time. So the numbers on Twitter, like, it's kind of like, you know, it's like on other services, like, you know, you see these very large numbers, but then that doesn't actually mean that all those people are going to see what you post. In fact, only a very small percentage of them will. On Mastodon, because both it is newer and therefore has fewer abandoned accounts, and also because it is not consumed in an algorithmic timeline by almost anybody, I think the ratio of engagement to followers is greater on Mastodon. In other words, you will have a larger percentage of your followers on Mastodon are likely to see your posts and engage with them than that same percentage on Twitter.
Yeah, what has changed in my usage since last episode, remember, was, you know, a bunch of third-party clients were banned. But as I said on the show, not all of them, and we had no official explanation. So what I had been doing was fleeing from the popular applications that had been banned to other less popular third-party Twitter clients. I must have bought like five of them. I would buy one, I would use it, it would get banned. I would buy another one, I would use it, it would get banned. But
this
and I distributed a lot of money to like a last burst of money to writers of these obscure third-party Twitter applications. For people who don't know, my weird way of using Twitter has always been to be a Twitter completionist. I would read my entire timeline. Like, I follow a small number of people who don't post a lot, but I would read everything that everybody that I follow posted. And I would also read all of my at mentions and all of my direct messages, right? That's, you know, how I've always used Twitter, which is weird, but whatever. So I was using the third party clients because I tried using the first party one, but it's obviously it's filled with ads. It does have the algorithmic timeline, but it also has the following timeline, but not the for you timeline, but the following one, which is supposed to not be algorithmic. But I was noticing the same thing as Gruber was noticing. I was like, this can't possibly be my replies. Like, because, you know, everyone didn't leave Twitter, right? And it's just, it seemed to me that I wasn't seeing all my... So I would look at the third-party Twitter clients when they were still working, and sometimes they would show more than the first-party ones. Sometimes the first-party one would show more than them. Sometimes they were the same, but everything just seemed off, right? Okay, so now the third-party ones are gone. They're all banned, right? So I'm just using the first-party client. And again, I was noticing the same thing Gruber was noticing. I'm like, this can't be... Like, all, you know, I'm looking at, again, I'm looking at the following timeline, not the for you timeline. I'm looking at the supposedly non-algorithmic timeline, and I'm looking at my mentions and notifications in the first party client or on the web or using TweetDeck, which is also a first party thing. And I'm like, this can't be everything. And sometimes I would try to run searches and I would find ad mentions of myself in searches that didn't appear in mentions. And basically, what I had to do at a certain point, I guess like 2 or 3 days ago, was I went to my accounts, my account, my Hypercritical account. I don't know if I did it on the RecDiffs account, but anyway, on my Twitter accounts, I posted the same tweet and I said, the ban on third-party Twitter clients has severely impaired my ability to read or even see all mentions slash replies directed at this account. Please consider following me at Mastodon, blah, blah, blah. And I get my Mastodon link, right? Because I can no longer use Twitter for what I use it for. I can't be a Twitter completionist because I don't believe that I'm seeing everything that I'm supposed to be seeing. And I can't use it as a communication medium because as far as I can tell, I'm seeing a fraction of a percent of the people who are at mentioning me, no matter what I do. I'm not looking at the algorithmic timeline. I'm supposedly looking at like my mentions, right? Or the non-algorithmic timeline in the first party client. And so it's just like, as far as I'm concerned, Twitter doesn't work. Now, is this because they're having weird back-end problems and queues are overflowing and things are getting dropped? Or is this because even the non-algorithmic one is algorithmic and they want me to pay for Twitter Blue to, you know, to kind of like the Facebook move where it's like, oh, you know, you built up this big following on Facebook. Well, now if you actually want to reach those people, pay us, right? But Gruber does play for Twitter Blue and he's also having the same problem. So Twitter's just broken, right? And, you know, again, I was not leaving Twitter because I was still getting value out of it. There's people I follow there who aren't on Mastodon, although I wish I would come over, but they're not there yet. And I would still see things there that I didn't see in Mastodon. So I was living in two worlds. I was not leaving Twitter, you know, to like just setting it aside or I can't look at it anymore. I was trying to use it as much as I could until all the value fell out of it. And through whatever has caused this to happen, most of the value has fallen out of it now because I can't use it. So if you're following me on Twitter, consider following me on Mastodon. You know, it's just Syracuse@mastodon.social, because if you're sending me stuff on Twitter, I literally can't see it anymore. I don't know why I can't see it. I don't have an explanation, but I'm just using the first party client of the website. You're trying to mention me and I can't see it. And I don't know what the solution is. So please come over to Mastodon where the software actually works.
I love like, We all have our reasons for leaving Twitter. You know, some of them are moral, some of them are political. Yours is the software
is
broken.
It doesn't work. I can't exactly like Gruber said. Like Gruber said, this is how he was interacting with the Daring Fireball audience. But if he can't see what they're writing to him, he can't use it for that anymore, right? It's not fair to anybody involved because people are writing and they think that you're seeing it and ignoring them and you're not seeing it, so you don't get to, you know, communicate with them. It's just bad.
That's amazing. You're totally right. Like this is a totally fair and reasonable reason, but it's just so funny that this
and
this
even
is
and speaking
what
of like
you
know even before that, I had made a conscious choice to if I had something clever to say it on Mastodon first or on Mastodon only. So I'd already made that transition, but I was still looking at both places, right? Still trying to maintain my presence there. And even now, like, for the announcement accounts, like if I post something on my blog at Hypercritical on Twitter, I'll post it there. Like just like we post the at ATP FM, like we're going live thing to Twitter.
No, we don't.
It will continue to be like,
I was going
to
say, I don't think we do anymore.
Well, I think we should. If
we don't anymore, because that was my task. And once I couldn't use an app to do it anymore, last week was the first week we didn't do it.
Well, anyway, I'm still posting announcement stuff and, you know, when I can on Twitter as well, because you can't, like, there's no way that everyone's going to see my pinned tweet. And this is the first time I've ever pinned a tweet to my thing on Twitter, by the way.
You can do that?
Yeah. Because it's not fair to the people who don't listen to the show, don't know. They just be like, oh, what happened to John? Where did he go? Right. So I'm going to continue posting my stuff there, like when I have a blog post or something else like that. But if you want to converse with me or see my stupid jokes, come over to Mastodon.
Well, they finally got you. All right. Moving along, Frank Ramblings had some feedback on Valentine's Day at White Castle. How did we arrive on this topic? I remember talking about it, but how did we get there?
It was sliders. It was sliders. And by the way, the quick follow-up on that is that, yes, there are some people in the United States who use sliders to mean sliding glass doors. There are also people who call them door walls. I have not been able to pin down
door
sliders.
Walls?
Door walls. Yes,
apparently,
in Michigan.
Yeah, apparently it's a Michigan thing, which I find to be ridiculous. But
all right, I'm
that's
a little
a
bit
thing.
Biased being from Ohio, but that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Well, so the thing about sliders is I cannot pin it down geographically because people from all over the country said both we call them sliders or no one here calls them sliders. We've covered a lot of the country from California to Michigan to Florida to New York. Both yes sliders and no sliders from like all these places. So I don't understand. But anyway, it is definitely a thing. It is not just a Marcoism. But I would say that the majority of the people hadn't heard of it, but enough people had, and they're just from all over the place. Door walls, I think, is based on an advertising thing, maybe some company that someone explained it to us. Yeah, that was like a TV ad and that caught on. Anyway, setting that aside, that's why we were talking about, as I said, sliders, those little hamburgers. Then we started talking about White Castle, and then someone mentioned something about getting a Valentine's Day reservation at White Castle, and that's what this is about.
All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. So Frank Ramblings writes, one Valentine's Day over a decade ago, when I was hopelessly single 20-something living in New York, I decided to grab takeout at the White Castle near my office on my way home from work. I figured that was the one place I wouldn't be surrounded by couples. I opened the door to find all the tables covered with red and white picnic tablecloths, you know the ones, and a uniformed member of the White Castle staff standing at a host stand greeted me to ask, do you have a reservation? I'm sorry, I probably shouldn't be laughing, but this is too funny. Apparently, for people of a certain age who grew up in the area of malt shops and jukeboxes, White Castle is quite the nostalgic date night destination. The place was full of older couples enjoying their sliders with a smile. The best part is there was full table service. Staff members were bringing the couples' orders to their tables and serving them soda from the fountain in plastic champagne flutes.
That is awesome.
I think it was also Frank, but somebody pointed out there's a post on eater.com from 2017, which goes through the history of how this came to be. I couldn't help but read it, and it was delightful. It wasn't a terribly long read, and I loved it. So you can check that out if you are so inclined. It's great. Anonymous writes, I was listening to the latest episode of The Bootleg while at work earlier today when I heard Casey mention the guy who downloads episodes and listens when at work on a submarine. I wanted to share my odd listening experience. I work in a high security environment where I can't have any personal electronics other than certain types of CD players. Each week, I either use G-Podder on my PC or I dig through the Apple Podcast Library on my Mac to pull the newest episode of The Bootleg and burn it to a CD so I can listen while I'm at work. Well done, anonymous listener. Well
Rip,
done.
Burn, mix.
That yep, is right, fantastic. Right. And just for everyone's sanity, I did go back to this person and ask, can you at least use MP3 CDs? That way you don't have to change the disc every 80 minutes, which is like, you can't even get through one episode of our show.
Oh, that's true. I didn't even think about
maybe
that.
Maybe he has an MP3 CD player, and sorry, rip mix burn, not rip burn mix. It's been a long time.
Yeah. Anyway, so it is, so Anonymous did say they are allowed to use certain MP3 CD players so that we at least avoid the 80-minute limit per disc.
That's incredible. I did not even cross my mind. I'm glad
every bootleg is a triple album.
you're only allowed to use like, you know, like vinyl records, and you have to flip it over every 18 minutes or whatever.
All right, then we can't help, because we're us, we can't help but do a little bit of follow-up about the member special that you probably haven't even heard yet. So you can either skip the chapter or you can come back to this later. Again, atp.fm/join. David Watson wrote in with regard to the language change in the Hunt for October. If that doesn't mean anything to you, again, listen to the episode. David writes, the word the political officer says when they switch languages is Armageddon, which is the same word in both English and Russian, which I think I had known once upon a time, but had completely forgotten. So I thought that was very cool. Additionally, Patrick Warren writes, the Hunt for October episode was my favorite movie club episode so far. Thanks. Well, thank you, Patrick. The Whistleblower from 1986 is my favorite Cold War movie. As a sonar tech in the Navy from 81 through 85, it was very accurate in its details. On my ship, a then new Spruance class destroyer, we didn't use a dot matrix printer or a computer to identify subs. The computer was Hollywood fantasy, And now this is me. I thought this was fascinating. This is such an obvious point that I didn't consider. So coming back to what Patrick was writing, the computer was Hollywood fantasy and the printer would have been too loud. Duh. How did I not think of that? A dot matrix printer hammering away in the middle of the ship that's supposed to be running silently. It's such an obvious thing that I just did not even cross my mind. Anyway, back to Patrick. We had an electrostatic printer which plotted the sound sent back from a sonobuoy by frequency, an eyeball, a pencil, good headphones, and reference books. It was a very manual process, and I spent as much time being trained as I did on the ship. To this day, I can still write reverse and backwards as we had a side lit plexiglass status or target board in the CIC, what is that, Combat Information Center, I think, that we had to keep updated from the backside with a grease pencil. The navigator with his charts and grease pencil didn't seem out of place at all. I thought that was excellent feedback, very interesting. And then finally, Adrian Mester wrote in to point us to Destin from Smarter Every Day, which is a YouTube channel similar to CGP Gray's. He did an overnight right before the world ended on the USS Toledo, which is a Los Angeles class attack submarine. He has a playlist that Adrian linked and we'll put in the show notes. I want to say it's like 9 videos, each of which is like around half an hour. So we're looking at 4 hours of content. And I started watching one of these just a day or two back, and then promptly watched all of them because I could not help myself. They were freaking fascinating. So if you are at all interested in the Hunt for October and submarines and things of that nature, absolutely worth your time. I thought they were incredible. So go check those out.
I watched those when they were released. They're really good. A YouTube playlist is always good when it starts with a submarine poking through the Antarctic ice or wherever they were in that first episode.
Yep, it's so good. It's so, so, so good. So yeah, check those out. All right, let's do some topics. And I understand that we have a question from the audience. Mr. Arment, if you please.
I do. All right, so in case no one has ever known this before, the world of USB-C shaped plugs is a little bit complicated, and you don't always get things working the way you expect them to when you plug a cable that looks like that into a hole that looks like that and that seem to connect and seem to be compatible, and even both say USB-C. I don't know if this is a common problem. So anyway, the latest USB-C thing that's annoying me is that USB-C charging is as universal as USB-C cables, which is to say, not very. I have an increasing number of devices that are accumulating in my life that have USB-C shaped charging holes, but do not support USB-C power delivery or PD, as far as I can tell. And so therefore, you have to use a USB-A charger and an A to C cable to charge
what?
These.
Oh, that's so gross.
Yeah, and this is it's mostly cheaper or lower end stuff, or less sophisticated, let's say, electronics. Stuff like I have USB hand warmers, which, by the way, I love USB hand warmers. Gloves all suck. I have tried so many gloves of all different brands. That brand you just said in your head, yes, I tried it. I swear, I guarantee you I tried it. Yes, that one too. Oh, he hasn't? No, trust me, I have. I have tried every kind of glove from every brand at every different price point, made of every different material and layering strategies and everything. Gloves.
Don't forget about mittens. We talked about this on a past episode. Someone should find the link.
Yes, mittens also suck. They suck for different reasons. It's for instance, it's very hard to manage a dog leash or ride a bike while wearing mittens. Now, when would you ever need to do that? Well, in my life, I do those things a lot. Every time I leave the house, I'm either managing a dog leash or a bike. So it is quite a thing. So anyway, mittens are terrible.
I'll just repeat what I said when last time we talked about it, that if your hands are that cold, your body is probably improperly dressed. And I wear gloves every day when I walk my dog out in the cold, and I'm fine. Anyway, continuing.
So, and yes, I've tried those lobster claw gloves where it's you have one finger free. Otherwise, it's a mitten, or the two and two doing that Star Trek thing. Anyway, they all suck. And the solution I have found to warm hands in the winter is to have the gloves that, when listeners and Casey, when John Siracusa is really frustratingly right about something and you don't want him to be right, but he is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a couple years ago, John Gruber gave me his glove recommendation, and I'll look it up and put it in the show notes. It's these like thin, I think North Face gloves, and it's just, you know, basic thin gloves that have like touchscreen compatibility through some of the fingers, and those little like grippy dot things so that you can like open a dog poop bag and stuff like that. And I first tried these, and I'm like, these are not warm at all. These suck. I can't believe Gruber recommended these. Why did these are the worst gloves ever. And because I remain so dexterous and I can use my phone through them and have the little grippy dots and everything, they're a really good version of that kind of glove. And so they just became my most frequently worn gloves. And I just had cold hands all the time. And I'm like, well, you know, the warmer gloves that I've tried all suck for different reasons. So anyway, yes, even those, even your brand that you're thinking of right now, I have tried them and they do suck. So I've realized that, oh, and yes, I have tried heated gloves. Those also are a thing that are real. They also suck for different reasons. Mostly that, like, they put the battery in, like, that big kind of collar part that goes over your wrist, and it just becomes this giant, bulky, unwieldy thing, and the heat wires are never where you want them to be. Like, the you know, the whole glove doesn't
warm
up.
That battery pack should really be on your waist, right?
Oh yeah, it should be the size of two iPhone 14 Pros, and you just put it in your pocket and change it every 90 minutes. That sounds like a
lot
of fun.
Not this week, everybody.
Not this week. That sounds awful, by the way. We'll get to it. Anyway, derail of a derail. So, USB hand warmers. I discovered these last winter, and I've been using them, and I have a couple of cheap ones from, like, you know, random Amazon no-name manufacturers where, like, it's just a whole bunch of vowels strung together. And I have some nice ones from Zippo. And they're all really good. Like, and the Zippo ones I use the most, I'll put those in the show notes as well. But yeah, they're fantastic, and it has changed my game, because if you're just holding a USB hand warmer, you know, you get two, so you have one in each pocket, and you can then use the thin, useful, dexterous gloves and still have warm hands. And it's way, and like a thin glove with a hand warmer, and for me, is way warmer than a thick glove without one. So anyway, hand warmers are great. However, the aforementioned cheapo Amazon hand warmers have USB-C holes on them, and I can't charge them with USB PD plugs. Same deal with a few other things I have in my house so far. I have a couple of, I think I even have a battery pack that works that way. By the way, USB hand warmers are also battery packs if you need them to be. There's a wireless microphone charger. There's a whole bunch of stuff in my house that's kind of like low end or cheap or no name stuff that has USB-C holes for charging. But if you plug in a USB-C PD power supply, it will not charge it. You have to charge it with a dumb old USB-A regular, like, you know, 5 volt, 2.4 amp or lower supply. So my question to the listeners is this just an impossible problem for these devices? Like, is it just that these devices were too cheap to actually implement USB-C PD support correctly to, like, negotiate with the plug what they should need? Or is there some kind of USB-C plug-in charger that I can get that charges everything via a USB-C hole, including these dumb old USB power devices that expect dumb old USB power over a USB-C cable? Like, is there some desktop? Because I've tried every charger I have. I've tried the Apple ones, the Anker ones, the RAV Power. Like, every plug-in USB-C PD charger brand that I own, I've tried them all. I thought at least the Apple ones would, because they're usually really good. But nope, I haven't found a single one yet. So if anyone knows, is there a USB-C plug-in charger? Multi-hole is better, but single hole, I'll take it if it's all I can get. Because if there is, I want to replace all of my travel chargers with those and a few of my home chargers with those. I hope that exists, but if it can't exist, we have a lot of people in our audience who know, like, the USB-C power specs really well and everything. Please tell me if it can't exist for some reason. But it's just this annoying thing that, once again, USB-C is not universal in some weird little odd way that is documented nowhere.
You want to replace all your travel chargers because they can't charge your hand warmers? Wouldn't you want to, like, I can understand it's convenient not to have a bunch of extra chargers in your house, but don't replace all of them. Like,
well,
when you travel,
I only use like three of them. Like, it wouldn't be a huge replacement deal.
But changing up all of your important chargers for the one that can charge your hand warmers seems unwise to me.
But it's not just the Hanovers. It was like, and so I keep, the point is, I would love, the whole point of moving to the world of USB-C is, hey, you know what? Finally, we can get rid of all these custom cables for everything and just have one cable that charges everything, except your iPhone or an Apple Watch. But one cable that charges everything. That would be great. And this, and it's just yet another exception to that list that now I have to carry around now a USB-A brick and an A to C cable just to charge certain things in my life. So if there's a brick out there that has USB-C holes that can charge everything, I would love to know that. Thank you.
You know, this is tangentially related, but this reminds me that recently, actually it was maybe late last year, I somehow was directed to, I want to say maybe Christina Warren pointed this out on Twitter. Hey, remember Twitter? Anyway, pointed out this thing. It's horribly named, the C2C Caber QU, C-A-B-E-R-Q-U. And this was a Kickstarter. It is also, I think, a product, like a full-on product now, because I received my Kickstarter, you know, whatever thing. And what it is it's a extremely basic circuit board. And it has a whole shed load of LEDs on it. And you plug one USB-C cable into this board on both sides. So on the left-hand side, you plug in one end of the same cable. On the right-hand side, you plug in the same, you know, the other end of the same cable. And what it does is it lights up all of the pins that make contact. So what this means is, in combination with the owner's manual, you can see, oh, well, and I'm making this up, well, RX1 plus and minus are connected, TX1 plus and minus are connected, VBUS is connected, shield is connected, ground is connected. Oh, this is just USB 2. Oh, wait, this other cable has another 300 different things connected. Oh, that's a full-on Thunderbolt cable. And so what it lets you do is figure out exactly what the hell the stupid USB-C cable is that you have. Because just like freaking HDMI, you can never friggin' tell what a cable is. You can never friggin' tell. There's no consistency as to how they're labeled. They're often not labeled, and you never friggin' know. So this thing, I don't remember what I paid for it. It was somewhere between $20 and $50, which is between $10 and $40 too much, because this shouldn't be a problem. But be that as it may, this thing is incredibly useful. And again, I will put a link to the show notes, or put a link to it in the show notes. I definitely strongly recommend it. It is very useful. Again, it's not solving the exact problem you're talking about, Marco, but I did notice when I was at Disney World a couple of weeks ago, I was trying to charge, I think, the Playdate, and I don't recall which cable it was, and I was in a hurry, so I didn't like try to diagnose or debug or whatever what was going on. But I was trying to charge the Playdate, and I had a USB C2C cable that apparently didn't charge the Playdate because it wouldn't start charging. And then I plugged in a different cable, maybe like an Apple cable or something, and suddenly it charged no problem, like the same power supply, the same everything. So having this, I didn't have this in Disney World, of course, but having something like this, if I was at home, I would have, you know, compared the two cables and seen, okay, maybe this USB C2C cable doesn't do, to your point earlier, Marco, doesn't do USB PD. It just transmits like some bare minimum of power or something like that. And so, I recommend this C2C Caber QU, very, very, very useful toy to have in the house. But again, unfortunately, Marco, that is not solving your problem, and I'm sorry. Anyway, so Apple's going to make touchscreen Macs, maybe, possibly. You never know.
We'll see. I mean, it's not surprising that Apple has people working on this. And it's not surprising that people want this. You know, this is one of those things that I think a lot of people want before they have it. Or a lot of times if you might touch a screen thinking it's a touch screen, and then you realize afterwards it's not, and think for a minute, oh, this is broken. But then you get used to it. There's been a lot of arguments over the years for and against Apple to add touch screens to their laptops. One of the biggest and strongest arguments is that because people are so accustomed to phones and tablets and even PC laptops, which often contain touchscreens these days, you can say, well, people expect it to be a touchscreen. And so because people expect it, you should kind of just follow what people expect. And that's a pretty good argument. That being said, I have a PC that has a touchscreen. It's terrible. And not in the sense that like they did a bad job, in the sense that it's not very useful. And the few times I have touched it, Usually if I'm like trying to like brush pieces of dust off the screen, and then all of a sudden it like treats it as a mouse input and the screen moves, and I'm like, wait, what? It's just, it's not fun. And this doesn't even go into the problems of like, you know, ergonomics, or things like UI design of how the Mac UI would need to change to be more touch friendly. But I don't know. To me, this is the kind of thing that it doesn't surprise me at all that Apple is, that there are engineers assigned to work on this, but it would surprise me if it ever shipped that way, at least in the products that we know of today. Now, if for some reason there became some kind of hybrid iPad book, you know, down the road, whatever it would be, where like maybe something that has otherwise MacBook hardware would also have like a touch mode where you could, for some reason, like, I don't know, flip it around like this old convertible Windows laptops. Again, none of this sounds like something Apple would actually make. But if there was some kind of hybrid OS mode swapping thing, maybe it would make sense then. But I don't know. I think this is the kind of thing that I'm sure Apple is working on it. They should be experimenting with this on a regular basis. But I don't know if it's ever really going to be good enough to ship in any products as we know them today.
I think it's not just that people expect it, that that Apple might be working on it. And by the way, this is a Bloomberg story. We'll put the link in, but I think it might be behind a paywall. But the exact wording is the typical waffling that we've been seeing for years. I think the last time we discussed this was maybe a year or 2 years ago. That Apple engineers are actively engaged in the project, indicating that the company is seriously considering producing touchscreen Macs. So they're seriously considering it. Well, that's good to know. And based on current internal deliberations, the company could launch its first touchscreen Mac in 2025 as part of a larger update to the MacBook Pro. So it's all just rumors. They're not even willing to say that it's going to happen. It's just, you know, hey, we've heard more that they're working on it.
So you're saying there's a chance.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a chance. Like, nice. So and last time we talked about it is because they were updating the OS in ways that looked like it was helpful for touch, but it turned out to mostly be for the notch, or did it? We'll see. But yeah, so in terms of like, oh, it's what people expect. In the history of Mac OS, there have been a few things like this that have basically gone in the direction of doing what people expect, despite the downsides. The biggest example, I think, and this is going way back, is back when the Mac first came out, the way you used the menu bar, drop down menus in the menu bar, is you brought your mouse cursor over to the menu, file, edit, whatever it's going to be. You clicked on the word that was the menu title, and you held the mouse button down. While still holding the mouse button down, you would move the cursor down until the item that you wanted to select was highlighted. Then you would release the mouse button and it would select that item. And that was the only way to use menus from the menu bar on the Mac. Obviously, eventually Windows came out. And when Windows came out, they didn't do it that way. The way Windows did it was you can just click on the word edit. And then, you know, that's it. Take your hand off the mouse. The menu stays down. Then you would move the thing down to cut, copy, paste, whatever thing you wanted to do. And then you would click again to select the item, right? And you could, I think, in Windows do it the other way as well, right? But the clicking on the menus, as soon as Windows did that, and obviously Windows had massive market share, if you are a Mac user and you ever saw anybody sit down in front of your computer or another Mac, what you saw is they would go to a menu and they would click on it and it would blink. Like the menu would blink there for a second and go away. And they would just stare at the screen and be like, what the hell's wrong with this computer? Right? Because they were clicking, thinking the menu, you would stay down and you'd have to explain to them, no, you have to click and hold. And they're like, why would you have to do that? That's so much harder. It's so much worse. Now, the reason the Mac did it that way is because part of the philosophy of the Mac, and a valuable and important and good philosophy, was not to be modal, not to get stuck in a mode. Clicking and having the menu go down is essentially a mode, because at that point, the next place you click is either in the menu, and in which case you're interacting with the menu, or it's not in the menu, in which case that click doesn't count. All that click does, if you're lucky, is take you out of the mode of, hey, we want you to pick from a menu, and then the menu goes away. And the Mac way was more of like, look, you're holding down the button. You're not in a mode. You're holding down a button. And it's obvious that when you release the button, you're either going to select a menu item or you release it somewhere else and you're done with the action. It was a safer way to interact because you were never stuck in a mode. You were never in a situation where the click wouldn't do what you expected because, you know, whatever. But practically speaking, not just at what people expect, but it is easier. Holding down the button is a physically more challenging thing to do, just from accessibility perspective, and also is ever so slightly more annoying to people. If you've used a computer for a long time and you're not confused by the modality of pull-down menus, you're like, well, why would I want to hold the cursor? And that's so annoying. I know how computers work. Just let me click. And so many people, you know, voted with their feet in their wallet to say, I don't care about the philosophical purity of modelessness. I don't want to hold the mouse button down. And so Apple eventually copied the Windows way and said, okay, now from now on the Mac, you can click the menus and they stay down. You could also still do it the other way on the Mac. In fact, you can do that to this day if you would like. Go to your Mac's menu bar, click and hold on a menu item, scroll down to an item and let go, and it works. And if you're a Windows user, you may have literally never done that in your life. But it still works that way. So Apple sort of, I'm going to say, like, conceded or, you know, gave in to the common way of doing things. But it's not just that it was what people expected. It was also that there were advantages that people had expressed through their usage that they found more valuable than what Apple's things were bringing to the table. So with touchscreens, it's similar in that even though, Mark, you didn't find it particularly useful, and obviously Windows is not particularly touch-friendly UI and neither is macOS, people have an expectation that it'll work that way. And it is sometimes useful, for example, just dismissing a dialogue or the most common thing, scrolling something, right? It's a huge web page is in front of me. It's a gigantic touch target. I just want to swipe on it. I swipe on it. Nothing happens. I feel like my laptop is broken. That is the same experience of someone arriving at a Mac in the 90s, clicking the edit menu and watching the edit menu blink onto the screen for half a second and then sitting there dumbfounded going, what the hell is wrong with this computer, right? That is the vibe that I feel like could eventually bring Apple around on this, that it is a useful thing that enough people think it is useful that Apple would be willing to do it, despite the fact that none of these desktop operating systems are sort of touch friendly, right? And I don't think Apple needs to modify macOS in a huge number of ways to add this feature, because the expectation would not be, oh, we're going to ship a MacBook without a trackpad. No, of course, the trackpad will always be there attached to it along with the keyboard, right? You'll always have a precision pointing device. This is just touch as an augmentation. Now you can pinch to zoom somewhere. Now you can swipe to scroll. If you want to stab a button on a dialog box, fine. But I don't expect people to be doing pixel precise things, as that's why you have a pixel accurate pointing device. The main downsides I can see of rolling this out don't actually have anything to do with the UI or anything like that, especially if you're able to like disable this if you don't want it, or if it only comes on certain models. The main downside I see is hardware-wise, in terms of I would personally never want this, and I think professional users also wouldn't want this, wouldn't want to compromise the quality of the screen display for that touch layer. I don't think you'd probably compromise it because the screens on phones and iPads look great and everything. But if I had to choose between like worse anti-glare, worse color fidelity, anything like that in exchange for the touch layer, that's a big no-go to me. And I feel like at the pro level, same deal, because pro people don't want to be touching their screens. If you're doing, you know, professional work with graphics or color, you don't want your ugly fingerprint smudges all over the things. And you do want the highest fidelity possible. But setting aside that sort of high-end use case, which I think is kind of rare, I think it's almost kind of inevitable that Apple will eventually give into this in some way. This rumor is so confused by the discussion around it of people saying it's not really a touchscreen Mac. It's actually, like you were saying, Marco, a convertible thing, or really what it is an iPad with a built-in keyboard and trackpad that's not two pieces. And because Apple has all the pieces of all of those things, like those could all be true, right? The hardware and the software exists for everything that we've described. It's hard to say from the outside which one of those things they're going to do, but practically speaking, if Apple were to roll out a Mac laptop with a touchscreen, they wouldn't have to do anything besides make a glitzy video showing people pinching and zooming and swiping and scrolling. And they could ship it. And if they didn't compromise image quality, they could say, it's there. If you want it, you can use it. If you don't, find the setting buried in our terrible settings application to disable it, and you're fine.
You know, for the longest time, I always thought that a touchscreen Mac would be gross or uncouth or not cool or whatever. And I don't know, I feel like I've softened on that quite a bit over the last year or two. And even though it's not something I feel like I'm seeking out, I can't sit here and say that I haven't, you know, tried to scroll on my MacBook Pro, particularly after I've spent a long time using my iPad. Like if I'm using my iPad for a while and then I switch to my MacBook Pro for whatever reason, there's definitely times I reach out and try to scroll. And if that's what so many people seem to want to do, you know, what's it going to hurt to support that? And I hear what you're saying, John, about like, you know, the screen fidelity, and it's a good point. Like, you're not wrong. But
I mean, I might be, like I said, because the screen quality in the iPads is great. It's just, all I'm saying is that would be a bridge too far for me. And I think it would be a bridge too far at the high end. But for everything other than the high end and weird, picky people like me, I don't think it would be an issue.
Yeah, I agree. And like you were saying, this seems to be something that a lot of people want. Like, I haven't spoken to devout Windows users in a long time now, but last I did, which admittedly was a couple of years ago now, they often said, well, you know, I can't even get a touchscreen on a Mac. Like, what the hell is that? And I'm not sure why that's something that's extremely important to these people, but it doesn't mean they're wrong. It's important to them, and that's fine. And so I would be surprised if, you know, like you guys were saying, if Apple isn't at least exploring this. I think I would even be a little surprised if this doesn't get supported in the next five-ish years. But I don't know that it's solving a problem that I feel like I have. But since it is, at least the way I'm envisioning it, since it's additive, what's it going to hurt? Now, if they completely rejigger Mac OS to make all the buttons enormous, you know, well, I would take enormous
there'd be too much attention to Mac OS that has
been that's true
for them to bother doing that.
That's a very good point. I mean, and I would take enormous buttons that you can tell are buttons over the, you know, iOS 7 era. I don't even know if this is a button, but nevertheless, you know, if they're dramatically changing Mac OS to make it touch first, that would certainly give me pause and maybe sour me on this whole idea. But assuming it's mostly or entirely additive, like, what's it going to hurt?
Yeah, and to be clear, it would definitely be additive. So all the things you're saying, oh, it's ergonomically bad, you don't have your hand out in front of you, it's like, it would not be the primary input method. You'd still be the primary input methods would be exactly as they are now. Mouse, trackpad, keyboard, all that would be the same. This is just, it kind of like the pencil for the iPad, right? It's just an augmentation. And speaking of pencil, by the way, that should also work on a Mac with a screen like this. And unlike the finger touching things, Mac OS is 100% entirely usable with a good stylus, like no compromises. That's pixel precise pointing with the stylus, right? Which doesn't argue for them shipping a Mac without a trackpad. I still think that's a non-starter, but the possibility of a convertible type Mac with a stylus would basically not compromise precision at all, right? Because you can get pixel accurate with an Apple Pencil on a Mac screen. So you don't need a trackpad anymore. You still probably need a Harper keyboard if you're going to type or whatever, depending on how good their handwriting recognition is. But like, Apple has all the pieces to this. And despite them making the menu bar bigger and a bunch of the touch targets bigger on Mac OS, which we thought was going towards touchability for like drop-down menus, but ended up just being the notch or whatever, they don't need to radically change Mac OS. It's just a question of the will to do it and what product they want to roll it out in. And it's not even a big change. It's kind of like stuff like Stage Manager, where it's like, if you like it and we do a good job on it and people find it useful, great. And if you don't, just keep using the Mac the way you are. Like, we're not compromising, you know, again, setting aside the possible display fidelity thing or anti-glare or whatever. We're not compromising anything. And who knows? You may surprise yourself. Even if you're one of those people like me who doesn't want fingerprints on their screens, hey, you got an Apple Pencil? How do you feel about using an Apple Pencil on your screen? Oh, I can't use it on a laptop screen. The screen will tip over. What if the screen folded backwards? And you're like, maybe, you know, especially since iPad apps also run in Macs with the ARM processors. The pieces are all there. So I feel like eventually Apple will get around to it, especially the new Apple as of like, and the post-butterfly keyboard Apple that seems to be listening to what people want out of their Macs. I don't think this is like, people aren't clamoring for it. It's not a big demand. It's not, you know, it's not anything like the problems we had before, but it's the type of thing where eventually you get around to it. If you're in charge of the Mac product line and your philosophy is let's please the customer by essentially giving them what we want, what they want. It's not like, oh, we're just going to do focus groups and do whatever customers want. It's still the Apple philosophy of, we're going to try to give you a product you didn't even know you wanted, but also we will listen to customers. Also, we will be cognizant of the wider world. It's why Mac OS eventually added the ability to click a menu and have the menu stay down, because they listened to the wider world and they said, can we add this in a way that does not affect existing users who want to do it the old way? Because it didn't. You could just forget this thing really existed. I mean, granted, if you clicked and then released real quickly, the menu would get stuck down, but it wasn't that big of a compromise. But just so many people wanted it that way, and Apple heard that, right? And they essentially rejiggered their internal philosophy to saying that it's more important to give customers what they expect. And by the way, we here in Apple, as computer nerds, once we enabled this feature in our beta builds of macOS, you know, System 7, whatever it was rolled, I forget what it was, maybe it was macOS 8, I don't even remember the OS it came out in, you get used to it so fast. Just like, you know, just like you get used to, like, once every 45 minutes you swipe a web page on your Mac screen, it's so easy to get used to that type of thing. So the people developing it will eventually say, we're so used to it, we feel like we can't go back. We're definitely going to roll this out eventually, even if it's 2025.
Hi, Feature Marco.
Hi.
It is an hour-ish, hour 15. Well, I show an hour 15, but I was here early. Do you want to do one more topic, you two, or do we want to just move to Ask ATP?
Let's do Ask ATP, because I have a bit of after-show stuff.
Perfect. Go team. All right, now we got to scroll to the right part in the damn document that has Ask ATP. There we go. Okay, bye, Future Marco. I'll miss you. All right, let's do some Ask ATP. And Lee Jarvis writes, any mobile or iPad app suggestions for young children or suggestions on filtering out the apps filled with ads and IAP garbage? The App Store seems to do a terrible job with this. I have a few thoughts. First of all, Apple Arcade is good-ish for these sorts of things. I haven't done a lot with Apple Arcade, but there's like a jigsaw puzzle app, I think. I don't know if I'll remember to put it in the show notes, but there's like a jigsaw puzzle app, a Disney jigsaw app, I think, that comes from Apple Arcade, which does have IAP, I think, but it gives you, a pretty robust
IAP and Apple Arcade. I thought none of them had IAP.
Then maybe it isn't from Apple Arcade, or maybe I'm wrong about the IAP.
Because I was just thinking that, like, this question is about, it's about apps for young children, not necessarily games, but I feel like there should be basically the equivalent of Apple Arcade, but for kids apps, right? Basically, non-casino games for children, right? A place where Apple curates a bunch of applications that don't have in-app purchase, that aren't trying to sell my kid gems or whatever, and that are highly rated, right? And I know the editorial in the App Store kind of does that, but Apple Arcade is so nice and fenced off. Like, when when you get these Apple Arcade apps, they're just going to be fun games. They're not going to be sucking money away from you.
Yeah, that's a good point. But leaving that aside, so stuff that I've either heard good things about or used myself, the Toca Boca apps, T-O-C-A-B-O-C-A, we'll put a link in the show notes. I don't think my kids have used any of these, but I've heard very, very, very good things from several parents about it.
Yeah, I put that link in there. My kids all use Toca Boca apps as a kid. Obviously, my children were this age a long time ago. I'm hoping Toca Boca has not become corrupted and turned into a casino. but when I used it, the kids love these apps. They're cute. There's a ton of them. They're high quality. And more importantly, the kids enjoyed them. Like, a lot, one of the ones that I remember my daughter getting into was like very simple, sort of like coloring book type of game where you have like, I think it was like drawings of butterflies and you can fill their wings with different colors by you know, picking a color and pressing on it or whatever. Sounds like the most boring thing in the world, but you give an iPad to like a 3-year-old with that application, and it's like 1 hour of a car ride gone. And all she would do the whole time is make pretty butterflies and save them, make pretty butterflies and save them, make pretty. I still have tons of those pictures on my camera roll of like all the butterflies you made. Similarly, there was one where you styled hair with like a virtual blow dryer and you would cut it, and you just hours of entertainment for small children. No in-app purchases, no ads. Thumbs up, Toca Boca circa 2010.
I mean, I can tell you,
and probably still today,
in around 2016 or so, I can tell you they were still that good, because that's about when my kid was enjoying them just as much. And I'm pretty sure we did that exact same butterfly coloring game a lot. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were great. And as your kids get older, obviously the requirements and priorities will change. But when you have very young kids, you know, in that kind of like, 2 to 5, whatever it is, ish range, stuff like this, which is like, here's something fun to play with while daddy takes a second to like cook a meal, like it's it's that kind of thing, or like you're screaming in the car, oh my god, but you just have to get to grandma's house, like, please, just here's exactly. Color butterfly.
Oh, they have so many apps now, but I just scrolled and looked at it. Do you remember what the name, without looking, Marco, the name of the butterfly app was?
No,
because there was an audio sample that would say it, I believe. Paint my wings.
Oh, vaguely, paint maybe.
Wings. Paint my wings.
I don't know. I was not getting a lot of sleep during this time.
I played with paint my wings as a way to zone out. Yeah, paint my wings. Still there.
There you go. All right. Then my kids don't have this. It is actually quite expensive. I want to say it's like $10 a month or something like that. But and my kids don't use their iPad enough to justify it. But they have used POKPOK, P-O-K-P-O-K. It has several different like games or screens, whatever, in it, most of which are fairly like open-ended. It's not like you must do this sort of thing and then that sort of thing. It's very exploratory. Explorative. I don't know. I'm making up words now, but you get to explore things. And they really, really enjoyed that. That's again, POK, POK. And then we do subscribe to ABC Mouse, which seems at a glance like it'd be super gross. And it, the website is from like 99, it looks like, but the apps are, or the app is pretty good. And basically, there's a couple of different things you can do in ABC Mouse, some of which are kind of brainless and silly, some of which are genuinely learning. But my kids have learned a not insignificant amount from this app. They have a lot of videos on it. They also have activities on it. I typically buy a year's subscription for like $40 around Black Friday time. It is quite a bit more if you don't find a sale, but I would encourage you to look for a sale. Again, if you look at the website, if you look at the app, it looks like it's kind of janky, but it actually really does seem to be really good at teaching at an appropriate level for either my kids. And, you know, Declan doesn't play with it as much anymore. In fact, very rarely. He's 8, but Michaela is 5 and she still likes it a fair bit. So you can look at ABC Mouse as well. Those were the ones that I could think of, actually, I guess, and John could think of, but any other additions, Marco first?
I don't know if I have anything off the top of my head, because, I mean, the thing is, like, you know, as Lee alluded to, like, the App Store is not a good environment for this, so things change over time. So, you know, even anything that we say now, we have to say, like, well, when our kids were that young, this stuff was good, but now, who knows, right? Like, now, those same apps could have been bought by some other company that's one of those like extraction companies. Like, I don't know how many people in the public know this, but in the App Store there is this whole economy of these companies or equity groups or whatever that whose sole job is they will approach and buy apps from developers that maybe are like past their prime, like, or, you know, like, so like they have a lot of installed base, they have good reviews in the App Store, maybe they have things linking to them, but they're just not making a ton of money anymore, and these companies will like buy them from their developers and then just fill them with like IAP garbage and subscription scams and everything, just like coasting on the app's existing install base and reputation. And like, this is there's a whole economy of people who do that, and so any app that you go to look at in the App Store, it could have been a perfectly great app 5 years ago, and if it's still there now, like it might not have the same owner anymore, and it might not be a perfectly great app anymore.
It's like when private equity buys out a company like Toys R Us or Sears or whatever and destroys it.
Yes, exactly. So Noob17 in the chat points out Sago Mini apps. This is like Tokuboka, Sago Mini. We got a lot of great use out of that. I don't know how they are today because, again, see the aforementioned disclaimer, but those were fantastic, and we got a lot of use out of those as well. Unfortunately, when you're looking at, you know, apps for kids, if you're trying, especially if you're trying to avoid like ads and IAP garbage, there's a couple of small tricks you can do. Like, for instance, like my kid, we were as a whole family into Plants vs. Zombies 1. Back forever ago when that came out. And then Plants vs. Zombies 2 came out and, of course, totally ruined the game with all of this IAP garbage and, like, casino mechanics. And it's like, and my kid was super into it, like, a couple weeks ago. And I'm like, I'm looking at this thinking, like, I have a very hard time getting into this game because it is just constant, just emotional exploits, casino mechanics, just buy more gems and get more scores and get more. And the best thing is there is no ad free version available. Plants vs. Zombies 2 is, it just has ads. The only trick is if you put your iPad in airplane mode, the ads won't load and therefore will be skipped. And of course, he figured this out. I'm sure somebody told him on YouTube or something. And so that is a trick you can do. Like, a lot of times, if you put the device in airplane mode, many of the ads and scammy parts of them won't load. And so that's a thing you can do. But ultimately, for the most part, this is one of those things where, like, there is no shortcut. You just kind of have to, like, look at the apps yourself first before you let your kid use them. If this is an area that you're sensitive about or that you want to, like, you know, be attentive to, you basically just have to review them yourself, like, one by one. The same way, like, you know, like, parents who are, like, super strict about certain content being shown in TV or movies will often watch the whole thing first by themselves before they let the kid watch it. You got to do the same thing with apps where, you know, if this is an area that you care about and, you know, if you want your kid to avoid other stuff, you pretty much have to just download the app yourself and try it and see first. There's no other silver bullet except Apple Arcade, as mentioned earlier, which the whole selling point of it is you get games that don't have all this stuff. You know, unfortunately, they don't, you know, there are still going to be a lot of games that your kids will want to play, especially as they get older and as, like, their friends start telling them about games. Like, they're going to want to play other games at some point that are not in the little safe area of Apple Arcade. And so you're going to have to maybe take a more active role at that point if you still want to enforce this kind of stuff. But again, that's up to you. But anyway, yeah, there's no silver bullet. The App Store, boy, I wish they would care more about, and I wish they would have a higher standard around the types of mechanics that are permitted to be in games that are obviously targeting children. And I think it's, again, it's like, this is one of the worst things about Apple. Like, morally speaking, the amount of weird, you know, ads and casino mechanics and weird scams they totally outright not only allow but directly profit from in the App Store with games that are clearly aimed at children is obscene. And I think, you know, if we could get past other Apple, you know, shenanigans and moral questionable areas of how they operate, I think we'd look back on this time in history once we're hopefully past it in the future as, like, this is a real bad look for Apple. Like, what they do in this area and what they permit, what they look the other way for, as long as they're getting their 30%, is pretty shameful.
John, any other thoughts?
Nope, I think we covered it.
Go, team. All right, Brian Coffey writes, ever since moving to Mac, I've been amazed how you can have a document open and move it from one folder to another in Finder. You can even rename it. How can macOS do this? It is written by a longtime Windows user. John, explain this to me.
So the way Windows, apparently, according to Windows users and my vague experiences, would keep track of files, like, you know, someone writing a program for Windows, is they would store file paths, right? So, you know, C:\, you know, I don't know what the hell they, what are they? Program space files / I don't know what the paths are in Windows. Anyway, a string, an actual text
tilde one.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. just a string that has the path to the file, starting with the drive letter. Ridiculous. Starting with the drive letter all the way down to, it would say where the files, right? And that's why Windows users often have the experience, if they're using an application, that if they move the file out from, like, they open a text file in Notepad, and then they move the file, and forgive me if Notepad is better than this now, but I'll explain how it could be better than this now. They move the file out of the way, Notepad would still think it would have it stored in its memory. Oh, I'm working on C:\ myfile.txt, right? But you've moved it somewhere else. It's not there anymore. And one of several things could happen. One, if you save it, it will just save it back to where it thinks it was. So we'll save it to the directory, you know, we'll save it to the file path that it has in memory. Even though you move the file elsewhere, now there's a second file with whatever you just saved. Or the other one is, it will get freaked out and be like, I'm editing a file, but it's not there on disk anymore. Where did it go? I have no idea, because as far as I know, it's supposed to be at C:\ whatever, my file that text, and it's just not there. And you're like, yeah, I moved it. But it's like, but all I know is the file path, right? That is a bad way to deal with files, but lots of programs historically in Windows have worked that way. How does the Mac, and I'm hoping these days, how does Windows get around this? What is the alternative? Isn't that the only way to keep track of files? Don't all files have paths? Well, the first thing to do is within the programs, so this is why it takes a long time if you start off in this way, within the programs, the Windows programs, and the Windows API or whatever, it helps to have a construct for the program to keep track of files that is something more than just a string, that is something more than just a file path as written in text. You need some kind of abstraction. On the Mac, they've had various names over the years. There's 50 of them now because it's a whole platform. What are they called, Mark? Do you remember FSREF, FS, but there was some other thing that began with FS. There's NSURL. There's all sorts of other things that is like an object, a structure, a thing in memory in the application that is more than just a string.
Well,
why do you need
like,
that?
Even like at the C level, there's like the file handle, like the file pointer in Unix.
Yeah. Well, that is similar. That's a Unixism. And of course, Mac is kind of Unix, but Windows wasn't. So just even within the world of Windows, some kind of thing that either does not hold a path at all or is a more complex structure, especially in the GUI type thing. Because under the covers, a lot of we get down, I'll talk about file descriptors in a second. Once you have that, you can put all sorts of crap in that structure. Historically, what the Mac has done is put, there are structures in the various macOS APIs that put more than one way to keep track of a file within the same structure. And it will sort of say, well, if you can find it this way, do this. And if you can't find it that way, do this. And if you can't find it that way, do this. And at the very bottom of that list of how am I going to keep track of this file is like, if you literally can't do anything else, at the very bottom, I have a file path. But hopefully it never comes to that. The most common way to do this on the classic Mac, especially with HFS and HFS Plus file systems, is they had a unique identifier for every thing in the file system, just like a big long number that was unique for the entire volume. So you just have to keep track of it's on the volume, and the volumes had unique identifiers too. It's on the volume 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and it's file number 7, 8, 9, 10, right? And there was only one file called 7, 8, 9, and it's not the file name, it is just the ID, the HFS Plus unique ID of that file. No matter where you move that file, no matter how you renamed it, its ID would remain the same. And in that little structure, I forget what it was called. I don't think it was FSREF. It was whatever the other FS thing was, whatever. It would just keep track of the unique ID, the unique HFS, HFS Plus ID of that file. It would also have the path, and it would also have, it would have the volume ID, and it would have the volume name, and it would have tons of information in the structure, but it would prefer to use the unique ID. And that's how I would keep track of it. Modern macOS has similar type structures in its various APIs and similar ways of keeping track of it, but not every file system has unique identifiers. Most Unix file systems have inode numbers, which tend to be unique within a particular volume, but there are nuances there as well. With what Marco was talking about is at the C level, when you open a file at the very low level Unix C API, you get a file descriptor back, which is just an integer. That is an integer number keeping track of that file handle that is meaningful to the kernel for the life of that file handle being open. And it's just going to be a number like 1 or 2 or 3 because it is local to your process. It is not a unique number, like universally unique. You can't store it anywhere. It doesn't, you know, mean anything like that. It's not going to be 1 or 2 because it's already taken. But anyway, that's another way of keeping track of it, because once you have that file handle open, you can move that file around. You can even delete that file off the file system, but the file handle is still valid, because even though it's deleted and its entry in some directory entry in the file system has been removed, the blocks on disk are still valid because you still have a file handle open to it. So how does the Mac do this, and how do other operating systems do this? They don't use file paths. They use the best available technique given the file system and the operating system to keep track of the file, and that is independent of the file name and location.
Good talk. Nevin writes, hey, John, with your switch from jobby job to indie, what did you do about health insurance? Marco or Casey would be interested. I would be interested in your approach to health insurance, too. Well, let me jump in and answer for John. He did this on easy mode, and I'm very, very jealous. So tell me, John, what did you do?
Is it easy mode, though? Because
yes, it absolutely is.
So here's why it's not necessary. So what I did, the solution I did, which may or may not be available to you, is my wife works. She has always worked. She still has a regular job with health insurance. And we had already been on her health insurance, our entire family, for a long time, because her health insurance has been better than mine was for many, many years.
So now,
I say it's not necessarily easy mode is having two parents with full-time jobs, which we did for most of my children's life, is not easy mode.
Oh, all right. I will begrudgingly allow that. But specifically with regard to health insurance, it is 100% easy mode. I think I can speak for Marco, but I'll give you a chance a second. For me, once I left my job in 2018, I ended up going to healthcare.gov, baby. Thanks, Obama. And I pay about the same for my mortgage as I do for my healthcare, which sucks. And by the way, my healthcare sucks. It's not very good. It's expensive as hell. It's not great. I somehow have to pay for everything always because my deductible, I got the lowest deductible plan I could find, and my deductibles are still like $3,000 per person per year or something like that, which basically means, or at least my understanding anyway, is accepting like just general checkups and things like that. If anything out of the ordinary happens, they don't pay a darn thing. Like, they may give you a discount if they have a relationship with the doctor, but they don't actually pay for anything until I have paid out of pocket something like $3,000 per person, or the family as a family unit has paid something like $10,000 in a year.
And by remember, the way, this is you're not talking about paying your premiums every month. You still have to pay those. This is on top of the monthly bill that you pay just to have insurance.
Which is the same as my mortgage, which again, I mean, I live in a relatively affordable place, so take that for what you will.
Well, do you actually want to give your health insurance number just to terrify the non-Americans?
So my health insurance is something to the order of $1,500 a month, which is about the same as my mortgage. My mortgage, actually, last I looked, was a little bit cheaper. We overpay it, but that's neither here nor there. But I pay about $1,500 a month. So that's $1,500 a month every single month. So we're looking at, what is that, like $12,000-$15,000 in a year. And again, the only thing I get for that, the only thing, is checkups. And by the way, vision is not included. Dental is not included.
Those are different insurance. And so what he's basically saying is, if someone gets sick and you have to pay for something, he has to pay $3,000 on top of the $1,500 a month before insurance will start paying for anything for that sickness.
I mean, the details, I might have that slightly wrong, but yes, that is about the heads or tails of it. And again, if I get deeply sick and let's say I have like some $10,000 operation, so I'm paying in addition to the $1,500 a month, I'm paying $3,000 toward the operation, and then insurance will pay for the rest. However, if Erin then gets sick and she needs a $10,000 operation, she gets to pay, which means we get to pay, an additional $3,000, because her deductible, mind you, is different than my deductible. So then I need to pay the $3,000 for her. And then if Declan gets sick, that's around the time that maybe insurance will properly take over. So
and this is before, this is like the better version. In recent history in the US, there were also lifetime and annual maximums. So it's like, look, if you get really sick, if it's more than $50,000, we're just going to stop paying.
Yeah.
Like that used to be a thing too. And obviously
that,
the pre-existing
is one of the biggest things that the ACA, you know, AKA Obamacare, changed. Like that all these marketplace plans, you know, at least you know that if you have some catastrophe that is going to require you to have like a 200 grand operation series or whatever, like, you know that they will cover that. But that's effectively what you're paying for with all those premiums and everything. But the everything until you get there is horrendous.
Yeah, and like you said, this is to cover. Oh my God, that's what this is for.
Yeah,
it's not to cover anything day to day. You know, we've had to take a kid to the hospital for something that ultimately ended up being minor, but at the time, of course, you don't know. And those bills have been ridiculous, but not entirely awful. But the key is, if like, well, let you know, I think Declan was the most recent kid of ours to go to the hospital. Again, it ended up being nothing important, but at the time we didn't know. If he had needed emergency surgery, which was on the table as something that we thought might happen, that's when the insurance really helps. But the hospital visit, I think we paid like, you know, between half and 80% of it. And the reason we didn't pay all of it was because, you know, the insurance company has some relationship with the hospital where they'll bring down the, like, you know, list price, if you will, for, and I'm making up numbers at this point, but say this hospital visit was $1,000. Well, you know, it may happen that the hospital is part of my insurance network. So instead of charging $1,000, they'll charge $800. But that's what I had to end up. I honestly don't remember what we paid, but that would be what I would have to pay, is the $800. And again, this goes on until any single one of us hits, I think it's $3,000 or $3,300 for a year. And by the way, if I hit $3,000 for the year and I get sick on December 15th, if I'm still sick through the new year and I start accruing new bills on January 1, guess what, baby? $3,000 starts all over again, because fuck my life. Beep. So, yeah.
Well, you're lucky if you can cross a calendar year boundary and still have the same plan.
you know,
well, that's true too. That's
like,
true too.
You know, so I've spent most of the last 12 years or so on my own health insurance plans that I had to buy like this, and the vast majority of that time was spent on the ACA plans, like the Obamacare marketplace plans. And there's all sorts of complexities here, but you know, the gist of it, the basic wonderful loophole that they get around here is, like, you know, state to state the regulations will vary, and I know New York, probably like many states, has certain requirements of, like, the plan can't raise the premium by more than a certain percentage in a year.
And how much does your plan go up each year, Marco?
Well, so what they would do is every single year they discontinue all of their plans and just make new ones and make you totally re-enroll from scratch.
That's like buying
year.
A mattress.
Yeah. So you know, if you like your healthcare plan this year, well, I mean, first of all, you probably don't because it's just like Casey's. But suppose you have found a plan that you can afford, that covers you and your family as needed to whatever degree, and that has enough of your doctors and stuff in it that you can reasonably use it. Well, come around Thanksgiving time, you're going to get a notice in the mail if you live in New York saying, your plan's over next year. Sorry. Re-enroll with our new plans. Now, you go to those new plans, and you'll notice that they are all both more expensive and also worse. it isn't just one or the other. They're more expensive and worse, and you won't know. Oh, and you have to enroll by a certain date in December, but you won't know until after January 1st whether your doctors are really in the plan or not, because they're going to still be negotiating with the insurance company until well past that December enrollment deadline. So this has happened to me, I think, 4 times in the last 12 years where, like, I'd have to get a new plan, and then in, like, January, in mid-January, where I'm already on this new plan that now costs more and provides less service, then I get a note from, like, you know, my doctor center basically saying, oh, sorry, we no longer support, you know, plan XYZ. And, oh, well, thanks a lot. Now I have something to deal with. Like, it's been such a pain. I will say, you know, at least, again, like, with the Obamacare / ACA world that we're in now, as terrible as this is, it was worse before. Because I had to buy plans before that by a couple of years, too. And it was terrible. Because before the ACA, I paid even more. Like, the premiums were even higher for what I was getting back then. And they had those, like, lifetime limits. They had pre-existing condition exclusions, which is another huge thing. You know, at least with the marketplace plans, you know that you can go to the state marketplace and buy a plan pretty much no matter what. Like, you can get something. If you can't afford it, they subsidize it. If you have some kind of pre-existing condition, well, they have to cover you. Like, there, if you have some kind of chronic thing that's going to require expensive things, again, they have to cover you. That's part of why they're so expensive. But look, that's the role of covering everybody, right? So the post-ACA world is better than the pre-ACA world, trust me. However, it's still a tremendous mess, and this is still a horrible system, and I hope within our lifetimes this is made better in some large way, maybe
good
whether
luck.
It's like single payer or a public option or whatever it would be, who knows. But something, you know, Medicare for All, which is already, you know, pretty much, you know, in the ballpark, it's like, so something, you know, but this is just one of those things, like, every country has their BS, their crazy downsides, and I think this might be America's biggest one. And if anybody in our government or leadership or politics, if they really, truly care about small businesses in this
Amen,
country,
brother.
If
Amen.
They really, no politician or party is pro small business if they are against giving health care to everybody. Because I cannot tell you how many people I know who either didn't start a small business or abandoned their small business in its, you know, early stages because of a lack of health insurance.
Yep.
So many people, and so many small businesses are really only possible because, like, the person's spouse has family coverage through their job, so they don't need their own health insurance. Like, they're, you know, it's kind of being subsidized by other people's spouses' jobs. But, like, there are just so many people out there who would start a business on their own if not for this one big problem. And so, again, if you care about small business in this country, you should do as much as possible and support whatever politics you can to increase the social safety net, and in particular in the area of health insurance.
Could not agree more. And from the chat, somebody writes, I have pretty good insurance, but when I had my gallbladder out, I was getting random bills for over a year. One hospital, one bill for the hospital, one for the surgeon, and another for the anesthesiologist. This is completely normal for America. It's not normal, but normal for America, and not at all surprising.
Yeah. So we have a lot of work to do in that area. Again, I hope within our lifetime this gets improved in a big way. That's still just a hope, though. I mean, it's like, you know, what are we going to get? Self-driving cars, humans on Mars, or U.S. fixes our health insurance? Like,
yeah, none please. Of the above.
Yeah, it's going to be none of the above, but I'll take U.S. fixes health insurance.
I would give the numbers on mine if I knew them off the top of my head, but I think they actually might even be more than Casey's, but my coverage is probably better as well. And I think Marco's are also more than Casey's just because he lives in New York.
Unquestionably.
I'm above 2,000 now. A month.
I mean, that's actually less than I would have expected. But it's a crud load of money. I'm not trying to say it's not a lot of money, but given that you live in New York.
That you were just saying, yours are like 3,000 a person. I think mine are 7,000 a person. It's a lot higher.
That's brutal. Golly, that's bad.
Yeah, New York is not a cheap place for anything, you know, including health insurance. But that's, again, it's like this whole thing.
In New York, I can recommend a government job if you'd like to actually have decent health care. Although I'm sure that's getting worse as time goes on, unless you're a police officer.
That's a whole other
thing. Let's not even go there. All right. I think we're good.
Thank you to our sponsors this week. The New York State of Health.
Stop.
No, thanks to our sponsors this week. Hover, Mac Updater, and Guardian Firewall. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join at atp.fm/join. Join right now to go listen to that episode about Hunt for October and how we are doing popcorn wrong. It is glorious. So thank you, everybody, and we will talk to you next week.
So in our quest to find a listener in every profession under the sun, it seems you have sang the siren's call of window washers, Marco, and you have some follow-up for us.
So in last week's pre-show, I was lamenting that I was terrible at washing my sliders, my sliding glass
doors. Excuse me, I believe you mean door walls?
Yes, my door walls, which you know, get covered in salty, sticky crap because I live near the ocean and it's a whole thing. And I know this is the most first-worldy problem ever. We're going to get that right out of the way right now. Okay. So, I am terrible at cleaning these myself, and window washers don't work out here in the winter. A few people wrote in, they're like, just hire someone who works in the winter. I don't think you understand how it works out here. you can't just like drive your car here and just start washing people's windows. Like, that's not a thing. Anyway, so it's a whole thing. But the good thing is, through a combination of what people reported and what I had already purchased, I found something that works for me, and it is the most ridiculous method that you can possibly think of, which, of course, makes it the most Marco method, probably.
Well, it does allow you to buy a bunch of things, so that makes it the most Marco method.
So it allowed me to use a bunch of things I already had.
Lies.
That you had already purchased. All right. So I looked at the first link, I'm like, wow, Marco got to buy a cool thing, but I guess you already had this toy.
So, when the window washers that I normally work with in the summertime, when they were here, a big thing that they use is called a pure water system. And the idea behind this, and I have not read up on the science to see if this is actually true or not, but just that, please forgive me if it's not, but the selling point of these kind of systems is by using extremely purified water as like a rinse stage, or like to reach really high up windows that it's pretty hard to get like a squeegee all the way up to, like if you're standing on the ground trying to get like a third story window or something like that. Anyway, there's these like pure water quote filters that if you rinse the window with water that does not contain any meaningful mineral content, then when it dries, it doesn't leave spots behind because there is nothing to make the spot because the spot is dried minerals. And so if you have a clean window and you rinse it with purified water, in theory, it should not have spots. And there's all sorts of ways to do this. You know, the gist of most of the systems involves pumping water through some kind of like, you know, like one of those like bags of beads or whatever, like whatever the filter method is where you like shove water through a bunch of material to try to get crap
out of it. A pool filter.
Maybe. I don't know enough about it. Anyway.
Pool filters have just like a big thing filled with like sand and other type of stuff like that. And
yeah, it's stuff like that. You know, so whatever kind of
filter. It's nature's filter.
Yes. So there's
it's the same way the groundwater on Long Island works. It goes through the sand and it goes underneath the pine barrens, and we pull it up, and that's why our water tastes good.
There you go. Yeah. So whether it's reverse osmosis or whatever it is, you know, that method of filtering. So there are these things that pro window washers often use. And I had, after seeing my window washers use theirs, I had thought, well, you know, having window washers come out here is an occasional thing, and it's an expensive thing. And what if I want to wash my windows sometime when they aren't here, or like, you know, between the times I'm going to have them be here? Maybe I got my own little version of this. And so I did. Like last summer or the one before, I actually bought the smallest one of these pure water filter things they make. And I noticed that they said on the filter thing, that it came with these quick connect fittings from this brand, and I don't know how to pronounce it, so I'm going to try. It's just GEKA, so I'm going to say Geka or Geka. I don't know. But the Geka quick connect system. Now, another aside here, because this is me and this is the show. These are the nicest quick connect fittings I've ever used in a hose. Now, I have since bought them for all of my hoses around the whole house. I've put them on all the taps. They even have their own little like sprayer attachments that have them built in. I bought all of those and replaced all my like cheap crappy sprayers that come with the Amazon hoses. You know, I threw all those away, those cheap plastic things. These Geka Quick Connect things are so nice. And
a word of warning about that, because you live by the ocean, they're nice now. Follow up on this in a few years, because these quick connect fittings really do not take well to any sort of grit or corrosion, and that's what you're all about over there by the ocean is grit and corrosion. So see how they live.
And that's fair, and I expect that. You know, it's a metal fitting with rubber gaskets. Like, of course it's not going to age well.
And the metal slides back and forth, and it's a precise fit. It's a rough. I'm not optimistic about the long term health of these. Very cool, but you're right. When they're new, they're awesome.
Yes, and I've tried. Like I've in previous houses and previous hose setups, I have occasionally bought like a single quick connect setup from whatever was ranked well on Amazon. And I can tell you, this is a step above in quality. Like, this is really nice. So the window washing thing came with these. So I geekod my entire house and all my hoses. It's amazing. So that dramatically improves how nice it is to use hoses. Because, like, if you ever, you know, the standard, I believe it's called GHT, the garden hose thread, that, you know, that standard, like, you know, screw method of attaching hoses to each other and to faucets. If you ever see it, like, spraying water out all over the place, the reason why probably is that connector has to be screwed on pretty much all the way to actually be sealed. Because the way it seals is, As you screw that connector on, eventually there's like that rubber gasket at the base of each of the like the hole ends, and so you're slowly pushing the other end of the hose against that rubber gasket that's at the bottom. And if it's not pushing against it, or if the gasket is lost or cracked or whatever, or if it isn't pushing hard enough against it, it'll spray water everywhere. And so it's a pain in the butt. So quick connect things are just perfectly sealed normally all the time, and you just pop it on, pop it off. It is one of those like little life improvement projects. If you ever use a hose, ever, get these quick connect things for it. And so anyway, side note over. So I also had I think about a year ago, purchased this DeWalt cordless power washer. I am usually a fan of most DeWalt products. You know, it's like, you know, you have like the battery lock-in problem. Where like once you get any cordless batteries for cordless power tools, then like now I'm in the system. And now I got to buy everything for that system and only buy things in that system, because then I can use the same batteries and chargers everywhere. So of course, you know, I have a need. I get the DeWalt thing if there's a reasonable one. And in fact, I have this DeWalt blower that's just incredible. Like it's this battery-powered 60-volt flex blower thing. Awesome. Anyway, so I've had some good luck. So I got this DeWalt power washer thing that uses these batteries. And if you read the reviews on Amazon, it is exactly right. It is a terrible power washer. Like, it is just the worst. It has no power. It barely washes. Like, it is a terrible power washer. It, like, basically no pressure. You can just take the hose with your wonderful Geekaw Quick Connect system, and you can just take the hose and spray something and get about as much pressure as you can get out of this, quote, power washer. It is a terrible power washer, but it has a superpower. It has an attachment that lets you just pull water out of any reservoir, a bucket, a backpack, whatever it is. You can just, like, put one of those little floater things in it, and you can pump water out of that bucket or whatever at hose-like pressure. So you basically have a portable hose tank with it. So I had this thing sitting around, not being used very much, and I had my Pure Water window washer filter thing sitting around, not being used very much, and I thought, huh, I wonder. So, and right now, because it's winter, all of my outdoor hose fittings are turned off and drained for the winter so they don't freeze and crack. And, like, you know, like every fall we have a guy come out and turn everything off and blow out the irrigation and whatever, you know. So, however, I had one good idea. Last winter, I had them install a hose faucet thing in an outdoor utility closet that is, like, partly heated and insulated all winter long. So I have one hose I can use that has to get around the entire house. So I have all these, like, hoses, daisy chain and everything with all my Quick Connect fittings, like, all daisy chain all around the house. And it's this whole crazy thing. I'm, like, you know, tossing them to myself because I didn't want to, like, bother anybody. And Adam was at school. And so all crazy logistics to try to get these hoses, like, all around the whole house. But I was able to reach my sliders that I wanted to clean. And instead of using the squeegee and making a huge mess of it and failing at, all I did was I filled a bucket with, like, my window washing concentrate and water, maybe 5 gallons of water, a little, you know, one of those, like, you know, capfuls of this to 5 gallons or whatever. Filled that up with the water. I used my stupid, terrible cordless pressure washer to suck the soapy water out of that tank and blast it all over the sliders. And this is not enough pressure to, like, hurt anything. It's, you know, it's just spraying it, basically. So, blasting it with soapy water with my crappy pressure washer. Then, using my Pure Water system and like, one of those big, like, brushes on sticks that they use to, like, kind of scrub and rinse away all the soapy water with the brush with the Pure Water. And then I just let it dry. And it was freaking perfect. It was
so happy for
amazing.
You.
It looked like the process of me doing this looked ridiculous. Like, you know, all this, like, equipment, these blasting my windows with this weird pressure washing hose thing that's covering them in soapy foam. It looked ridiculous. And I know I could just get a bucket of soapy water and a squeegee. And if I was more talented at operating a squeegee, I know I could do it in probably a quarter of the time for, like, $12, but I don't have that skill, and I keep trying to learn that skill, and I keep not having that skill. So instead, I have this totally ridiculous solution of just repurposing things I already had in ways I didn't think they'd ever be useful, but it works ridiculously well. So this is my solution. It works for me. I'm sorry about how ridiculous it is, and I'm sorry to the world of window washers, which I now know listens to the show, at how I am probably not doing anything correctly, but this actually works really, really well.
Question about turning off your spigots other than the one that's in, like, the insulated space. Mm-hmm. Do you have the little drainy things on the inside, or are you just turning off the water to them? You know what I'm talking about, the drainy things?
On what?
So, like, you have spigots that are outside the house, right? And if you live in a cold climate, when the winter comes, Casey, you want to turn them off because you don't want water sitting inside those pipes and then freezing and expanding and bursting open the pipes and making you very, very sad, right? So usually you turn off your outside spigots. But what they mean by turn off your outside spigots, the goal is to get the water out of the pipe. So if you just turn to, like, a little valve or something in your basement that says, there, no more water is going to come out of this hose spigot. That's true, but the water that is in that pipe right now is still there. It is still butting right up against the spigot that's hanging out of your thing. So you need some way to get that water out. And you could go to the outside and just open the spigot, but that just might let like a little drip out, but you still could have a bunch in the long pipe leading up to that or whatever. So I'm asking you, Marco, if you have a thing inside your house that lets you drain all the water out of the pipe that leads to the spigot.
Somewhere there is a way to do that. However, I don't know where that thing is. And so that's part of the, like, the reason why we have like a guy come out here and like shut down all the things. It's like it's partly because I don't know where any of those things are, but I'm pretty sure we have them because like it isn't as simple as, oh, you just turn the knob back on, like on the outside, and it's back on again. Like, that's not how that works.
Yeah, I would hope in recent houses that you have that. My house is ancient and didn't have them, and I had to actually pay to have them installed. That's why I know where mine are.
Yeah. So it's just,
The thing I'll add, though, to that is, interestingly, if you have a very old house like I do, especially before I got my house insulated, which I know sounds terrible, but again, they didn't use a lot of really good insulation in the 30s. So when I got my house redone and they put actual insulation in the walls, it really helped our energy bills, let me say.
But
before that, especially when I was a new homeowner, and we didn't have those things, I would just turn off the water to the outside spigots, but I would know that there's water in there. And again, I would go outside and I would open the spigots and be like, come on out, water. But just a little bit would drip out. And I knew there was water inside the pipe, but there's nothing I could do about it because I didn't have the little valves. But I must have gone through like, you know, 7 really cold winters like that. And the reason my house survived and the pipes didn't burst is because the thing that makes my house warm in the winter is a boiler downstairs that makes hot water, and then that hot water goes through pipes to hot water radiators all through my house, and all those pipes start from that boiler, and they go up to the ceiling of the basement, and they go all around the perimeter of my house and up the outside walls of my house to all the radiators that are on both floors of my house. And the hot water that's in those pipes radiates all of that heat into the basement, and it basically radiates all that heat onto the pipes that are leading to the spigots that are poking out into the freezing cold air. So just waste heat from my house, like heating, like if you took an infrared camera and probably pointed it at the outside of my house, you would say, why are all the spigots glowing a different color than the rest of the house? Because they're being warmed by the hot water pipes. And I know, like, I put like insulation around as many of the hot water pipes as I could find, but it's a losing battle because the water that comes out of the boiler is really hot and it's going through cast iron pipes. And if you put like near boiling water through cast iron pipes, it's going to the thermal mass there. It's going to heat up the cast iron and it's going to make those things radiate heat. And that's why our basement, which has quote unquote no heat in it, is often the hottest room in the house because that's where the furnace is. Now that we have the insulation, it's not a big deal. And I have the valves and everything is much better now, but it kind of amazes me. I think a lot of like how you survive in a place like New England that actually does have winter is that anything that has survived in New England for 20, 30, 40, 50 years has some attribute that makes it like dummy proof. Right. So in my house where I couldn't do the right thing with the spigots, don't worry about it. This house has been here since the 30s. If the pipes were going to burst, they would have already. How does it survive? Probably comical inefficiency and lack of insulation. But like, suffice it to say, the things you still see standing in New England are able to take through whatever means the abuse that winter is going to put out. That's why I always worry about like new construction is like, okay, do you understand why the old construction worked? Because it might not be working for the reason you think it is. In your new construction, you probably need those little thingies that Marco doesn't know where they are. The thingies are basically like a valve inside your house that lets you open on the outside valve, right? And then you also open on the inside valve, and that inside valve is lower than the outside valve. All the water drains out of the pipe then. This is after cutting off the supply to the water. Then you open up the other end of this, and then all the water drains out of the pipe. And now your pipe just has air in it, and you're good to go. This has been plumbing talk. I wish I knew the names of any of those things, but I do know where they are.
Good talk. Titles.
They finally
I really it. Liked I liked Casey's Gotcha Day. I thought that was funny, but I really liked distributed a lot of money, and I like that because John said it and it is such a Marco thing to say, so I that's my vote. I think it's hilarious.
The gigantic childhood nostalgia hit of Paint My Wings is making that my number one.
I do like Paint My Wings a lot.
You got to get that audio sample. You should put it in the program because my imitation of it didn't do it justice. Let me see. I can probably download it.
We have your imitation.
You can have both. I got to see in the. I got to go to my purchases. If I'm on my phone, not my iPad. I forget. It might have just been an iPad app. My purchases purchased my face.
I wouldn't veto paint my wings. Paint, I like distributed money.
Paint
more.
My wings. There it is. Oh, cannot connect to App Store. Retry. Cannot connect to App Store. Retry. Cannot connect to App Store. Retry. Okay.
Great right, podcasting then. Content here.
That's, I was just tapping the button. Paint. I just saw it on their site. It must still exist. Paint my wings.
I like the arrow of time also. I think the distributed money is that's good. Like I'm that's good, but I think paint my wings is better. Let's see.
Paint my wings.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of good suggestions this time.
Does your washer thingy like reach up? Do you have a high things they need to reach? Like are you doing like windows that are above the level you could reach just with your hand?
I mean, I guess the highest is maybe like, you know, 8 feet. So like I can't quite reach it necessarily,
it squirts there.
Yeah. I'm not going like a whole story above where
you're
I'm
not
standing.
Doing like the windows that are, I know you've got windows that are like super duper high. You're not messing with them, right?
No. I just like, I'm not doing anything that's above the floor I'm standing on. Yeah. I can't, like, I kind of can't believe this works. But it totally does.
I mean, it gets to what I was saying last week. Like the trouble with the streaks is not so much your squeegee technique, it's that there's crap on your windows, and the crap in your case apparently the crap was in the water. Like, you know, there's crap on the windows, but if you get the crap off the windows and you put water on your windows that has crap in it, there's still crap on your windows. Right?
And the water here is it's not great. Like it's safe to drink, but there's a lot of like iron in it. Like sometimes it gets brown.
Is it groundwater for you as well?
Yeah. It's municipal, but it's well water. Like it's from wells that are around here.
Yeah, you're too close to the salt water for good quality water.
Yeah, there's tons of iron in the water basically, and so it's just there's always like you know like scaling and brown stuff. But yeah, it's like, this is the most ridiculous solution I've ever done involving like these two crazy tools that are neither of which are really made for exactly what I'm doing with them, but it totally works. I was thinking too, like, I mean, this would be overkill for an automotive application, but cleaning a car would be so much easier this way because you don't have to worry about drying it before the spots come.
If you watch professional car detailers, they do have a bunch of hose spray thingies that put on the foaming spray, and they do use power washers to essentially wash off the before you get to, you know, using clay bars and stuff like that. They do have things that look a lot like your little attachment. They're not power washers in the sense of like...
I bought a foam cannon a long time ago.
Yeah, but there's also like, even just for the rinse is also done with, it looks like a power washer, but it's not like, you know, the one you use to get moss off of cement. Like it's not that powerful, but it's a similar type of thing. It is serving the function of not just making it wet, but using the water to push crap off of your car.
All right. So we going with paint my wings then?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Okie dokie.
Cool.
Anything else for the live people?
I believe that's all for this week. Thank you, live people. And I guess we will talk to you. I believe we are normal same time next week, right?
For the foreseeable future, as far as I know, yeah.
Yeah, for a while. Good. Okay, great. So thanks, everybody, and we will talk to you next week.
Bye.
Kieran Healy put a link to a YouTube video showing payment wings. I think there might have been more than one sample, but anyway, Casey, did you see it in the notes there?
All right, bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.